My name's Trevor Hasty, and we're going to introduce our first speaker, which is Rick Becker from AT&T Research Labs in New Jersey. So I've known Rick for a very long time, since I joined Bell Labs in 1986. Rick was there. He was at Bell Labs before that, and this was AT&T Bell Labs, and now it's AT&T Research Labs. So I would say Rick is the epitome of a data scientist. He was then, and he still is now. He was terrifically, wickedly good with computing and managing data, and also a very smart statistician. And so it was, I remember joining Bell Labs and first meeting Rick. He was two doors down the, from my office, and I was still learning everything, Unix and S and things like that. And so I'd go to after the first few days, I went down to Rick's office and asked him some questions. Well, that was my first introduction to the culture in a place like Bell Labs. And what that culture is that before you ask anyone a question, you first try your hardest to figure out how to solve it yourself. And then you go, and if you can't, still can't, then you ask the question. Well, I quickly learned that from Rick. And then after that, I used to make sure that I really tried my very hardest, and then Rick's door was always open to me for questions, so I found him, he was very helpful and friendly. Rick, as you know, is one of the co-creators of the S language, and has been an ally of John Chambers and the other S developers right from the very beginning. The other thing that comes to mind with Rick was in the early 90s, we produced the statistical models in S and the software for doing GLMs and various things. And I was part of some of the teams there. And you know, I'd been there for a few years, and I was starting to feel rather proud of myself and my coding abilities. Well, next thing I discovered, we had code review. And I had to go into this room with Rick Becker and Alan Wilkes and submit my code for GLMs. Well, I came out with my tail between my legs a little bit and had to go back and do a few revisions. Anyway, we finally made it. So anyway, Rick is, this is the first R conference Rick has come to, and it's the biggest R conference, and he's our first invited special speaker today to talk about the 40 years of the S language. So please help me welcome Rick Becker.
Thank you, Trevor. Well, thanks, Trevor. And thank everybody for being here. It's very nice to see this great audience and to hear all the nice introductory remarks. It's been fun to come to the USAR conference. I'm here to give some personal talk about what went on at Bell Labs and the environment where we created S. It was a very interesting place. I'll show you in a, there's, there's a very young guy heading off to Murray Hill. I have to apologize for the quality of the pictures, but it's kind of hard to come back with pictures from 1974 in high quality form. So the first thing you notice is that I'm wearing a jacket and tie, which is what I thought Bell Labs was going to be like. I was disabused of that pretty quickly. And so nobody wears a jacket and tie unless they're trying to be a manager. You can see this thing has pointer too? Yes, look at that. So statistics research was right around in that part of Bell Labs. There is a lot of labs. This was physics over here and chemistry and things like that. This is a huge long corridor that goes all the way through the building. And there was an accelerator, not as big as Slack, but it was, we had our own little particle accelerator down on the physics side. We had people doing all sorts of physical chemistry, astronomy, just amazing things. So it was about 4,000 researchers in that building. And as Trevor was saying, the doors were always open. So you could walk down the hall and you could talk to pretty much anybody about anything. If you went, it's probably like here at Stanford, if you looked at the calendar of events, you'd see talks on every imaginable topic. And so there's a lot of cross-pollination going on. So I came to statistics research, and the two department heads there were Colin Mallows and Ram Nadadesikan. Colin was a really sharp mathematician. He was able to play in the whole math field as well as statistics. And Ram did a lot of really interesting multivariate stuff, had a book out that was published just about the time I came. And so that was a really nice introduction to high quality people to work with. We were part of the Mathematics Research Center, and that was Henry Pollack. There were about 10 departments, I think. I don't really remember if it was quite 10, but there were people doing combinatorics, doing optimization. There are two statistics research departments. There were mathematics of computation. Lots of exciting things going on there. And then within above that was computing principles research. Bob Prim and John Tukey. As you can see, Bob has the suit and tie on, so he was the manager. He, but he was actually a good computer scientist too. And if those of you who know Prim's algorithm for minimal spanning tree, that was him. John Tukey sort of dressed a little more casually. My wife said, "Did we just meet the janitor?" And he always had a black shirt and black pants, except when he had to dress up to go meet with the higher ups. But John was an amazing guy, full of ideas and full of things to do. So if you saw John, typically you came away with like three or four different things that he wanted you to try out, because he was always disseminating these ideas and letting people run with them. And sometimes you'd run into a wall, other times it would be really excellent stuff. So who else was there? So we can compare John before and after, but I think John's held up pretty well. John was there since 1966, so when I came, he was really the statistical computing guy, and he'd already written two books. So John's got a lot more books in him than I do. The one was computational methods for data analysis, which he did by himself, a lot of work on numerical analysis and algorithms for doing statistical computing. The other one was graphical methods for data analysis, and that was with Bill Cleveland and Paul Tukey, Paul being, and Bette Kleiner, sorry. Paul was a cousin of John Tukey, and so he was also part of our research team. So what was statistical computing like back then? For the most part of the world, you saw statistical computing as a batch process with what are called packages. Packages were like collections of self-running programs that often had some kind of funny language that ran them. So you might say regress age upon salary, or giving residuals, or some kind of semi-English-like language. Basically, the idea was that you'd take the data, it would stream through the package would compute a bunch of stuff and print out a whole bunch of stuff. Why would it print out a whole bunch of stuff? Because this was what batch computing was like in the day. I'll bet there are a lot of you that don't know this. You'd type your programs and your data and things like that on these crazy punched cards, which are also what you'd send in for your phone bill and for other kinds of things. things would get printed on this huge line printer. It's sort of like a chainsaw with letters on it. And it would print out big hunks of paper, and you'd get some big hunk of paper in your bin when you finish. So typically the turnaround time for doing anything, like a regression, might be 2 hours if you were lucky, depending on how long it took them to take your card deck, stick it through the card reader, run the job, and then hand you your printout. So it was important in that package era to have all the answers that you could ever want, because maybe you didn't think of what you wanted, but if it was printed out, then you didn't have to do another batch run to get it. Well, I had come from the National Bureau of Economic Research doing work with Troll, which was an interactive language for doing time series computations. And wow, when I got to this environment of batch computing, which we still had at Bell Labs, I was kind of surprised. Everybody had worked on underlying algorithms. So there's a lot of really nice solid work in the statistical computing subroutine library of algorithms for doing computations. So things like regression, robust regression, various kinds of smoothing, and all sorts of other things that you might want to do, as well as data management kind of things. So that was the environment I came to. We basically had a GE635 computer that was running a batch operating system. And on top of that batch operating system, there was a time-sharing system, which sort of was an add-on. The time-sharing system had completely different system calls than the batch operating system did. So it was really hard to work in both environments. But if you wanted any interaction, you wanted to be on the time-sharing side. But most of the big stuff was done on the batch side. So the SCS library was a real library, like there was a real librarian. Bob McGill was in that capacity at the time when I was there. Bob was a really interesting guy. He did a lot of work in graphics, along with Bill Cleveland. They were doing perception of graphs. And if you know some of Bill Cleveland's books on elements of graphing data and the other books that he put out, there's a lot of work in perception for how you'd understand what your graphs were telling you. But the SCS library was this basic set of things. We had a lot of interesting linear algebra, random number generation, and then other kinds of routines, like for giving you dynamic storage in Fortran, which didn't exist. So it would be a Fortran subroutine that did something funny underneath to give you an array of Fortran variables that you could then work with. So why do we work in Fortran? Back in the old days, computers weren't really very standardized. So it's not like you went to Intel and you got a chip for your computer and they all basically had the same instruction set. Every manufacturer, and there were a lot of them, would come out with a computer that had its own unique instruction set. The one thing that was a high-level language was Fortran. So if you wrote things in Fortran, at least you had a pretty good idea of being able to move it from one place to another. And the amount of effort that you put into writing all these nice routines, just like you do if you're writing a nice package for R now, there was a lot of work that went into putting together those routines, and so you wanted them to be able to move from machine to machine or environment to environment, especially if your computer center decided it was going to buy a new machine and the old one was going to go. There were some really interesting things as they transitioned away from some of the punched cards. We had people that had binary code that was the output of the assembler from the GE635 wanting to run it on the new machine. And they didn't quite get that those cards weren't going to work on the other machine. So there's also another interesting little thing. Barbara Ryder had written a program called PFORT, the PFORT verifier. And basically, you could run your Fortran program through this other Fortran program, and it would tell you what kinds of trouble you might be in if you tried to port it somewhere. And if you got a check mark from your PFort verifier, then you were pretty sure that you could take that Fortran program and move it to any other environment. So that was sort of the model. We put a lot of effort into the basic routines for computing, and we wanted to be able to move them and keep them and use them for other things. Trouble with SCS was to do some kind of analysis, you had to write a Fortran program that read in your data and then called the subroutines in the SCS library and then wrote out the results. And typically the reading and the writing was the hard part, and the calling of the subroutines was pretty easy because the subroutines were really well thought out, and there were a lot of them to work with. So it wasn't exactly the right environment to work with. And that caused a problem when we started to try to do EDA. So as I told you, John Tukey was involved in lots of things. He was a chemist to begin with. He did work in electronics. He invented the word bit for computers. He also invented exploratory data analysis as a topic. And the basic idea was that exploratory data analysis, sort of like data mining these days, was about looking at data, trying to understand what kinds of inferences you could make from it, but not necessarily provable inferences. You're looking for interesting things in the data, not necessarily something you could take to a court of law and prove that something was there. So it was about exploring and trying to understand data. And so if you haven't encountered this book, you should look it up. It still has an amazing set of things in it. It's a little slow by today's standards, but John did his work with pencil and paper for the most part. So a lot of his techniques were simple and very useful for doing real life data analysis. Interesting things. You wouldn't buy graph paper. You'd buy one sheet of graph paper, especially if you were looking for special kind of things like log graph paper or something like that. And then you stick it underneath tracing paper, and then you do your plotting on the tracing paper on top of the graph paper. Then when you took it away, all the crummy lines from the graph paper were gone, and you saw the data. So that was just one of the kinds of things that John would do. He invented the stem and leaf diagram, so a nice way of tallying things. You know how people write, if you're trying to count, like if we had to count the audience, and I started making marks on a piece of paper, and I'd do 1, 2, 3, 4, and cross at 5. John had a way better way to do that. His way was you do line, 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 line around a square, and then cross it. And you could always see if there was a missing one. You have 5 lines with a cross or 4 lines with a cross. Those were hard to distinguish, but a square with a slash across it was really easy to see. So that was sort of one of those simple little things that that John came up with. And he was always working. So John would be way in the back there, and he'd have his head down, and he'd have a piece of paper, and he'd be writing stuff in the middle of any talk that he'd go to, which he went to almost all of them. And then at the very end, he'd raise his head up, and he'd ask about, did you know that so-and-so did that work in 1935? So anyway, he was just an amazing guy. He had all this really great insight into data. And what we wanted to do was to computerize it, to make it so that people could at least look at their data with a computer quickly and easily. And also, so EDA was a big influence on all of that. So this is my horrible handwriting. See the date from November of 1974. So this was 2 months after I came. And I'd been talking with John a lot about statistical computing and Troll and the whole thing. And I thought, what we really need is something like an interactive SCS library, something that took the routines that we had and all the work that we'd put into them and then put it all together in a nice, easy-to-use way. So to provide interactive use of SCS routines for data analysis, so seemed like a pretty good idea. meanwhile, that was one concept. And meanwhile, John and I had been working on a thing that John started called GRZ, which is a graphical library. So it was a designed to be a device-independent graphics library for doing all the basic kinds of graphics that you do for statistical computing. And so, you know, want to be able to do box plots and all the things that were in the graphical methods for data analysis book that he'd already just done. There are a lot of exciting things there, too. That's a good old reference to look up, because although I suspect you'll see that pretty much the R graphics that you are used to in there, a lot of those ideas already were thought of in 1972. So, and they were in that book. So anyway, we were working on these graphical routines. And one of the weird things is that the par function that we've got in R came from S. That all came from GRZ. So there were all these graphical parameters that were able to influence what the details of your graph were gonna look like. So, by the way, the reason for the Z, it's sort of like we were just hearing about Hadley's concept of an R on the end of R packages. Well, all the GRZ routines had a Z on them. Because when you create this huge library, like the SCS library plus the GRZ library, you need some way to distinguish what you're talking about. So that was the Z part. And so then, around the same time as I was thinking about interactive SCS, I thought, you know what, we ought to have an interactive version of this device-independent stuff, too, because we want to be able to do graphics interactively, because a lot of EDA was about the graphs. And so the idea was to, yeah, well, okay, so this objective thing that I wrote here, I'll read it just since nobody else can read my handwriting. The general loader in a batch task that may take a long time to run. It is a batch task that took a long time to run. And so in a time-sharing environment with heavily used programs, we want to be able to do this all without using the loader so that we can have device-independent graphics. And so what that ultimately meant was that we had some assembler routines with pointers to routines in the graphics side and in the non-graphics side in fixed locations that we could always know we could call from by just using that particular location. And that way, we didn't have to have the loader do any work before running a batch routine. It would just pop it into memory and it would be in the right place and you could call the routines. Well, so we decided a little later to get together and actually do this stuff, because it took a while to work out the basic ideas. And so we had a group of people, as Trevor was saying, you know, there were always people around, and we'd sort of corral them into a room and start talking about doing our interactive SCS stuff. And so after one of those meetings, this is John's writing now, which is a lot nicer than mine. But you see, it's May 5th, 1976. This was when we finally came up with the idea of having a uniform interface to our algorithms. So the idea is this little circle is the algorithm. What we do is we put a nice uniform square around it. So we put some interface code around the algorithm so that all the algorithms have the same calling sequence, right? There's this is an input structure, and it's got a bunch of named components that are coming into your routine, and then we have an output structure with a bunch of named components that are going out of the routine. So we figured, okay, a bunch of stuff goes in and a bunch of stuff comes out, and the algorithm computes whatever is in the middle. And the algorithm we already wrote. So how hard could that be? But anyway, that was, I think, the real gem of the idea about S, that we wanted to make everything uniform so that everything would be callable. So then we thought about, how do you design this kind of language? Formal grammars were a big thing in that time in computer science. And so there were some tools for using that. We wanted to have a formal grammar so that the language itself was really clean and uniform and simple. So we wanted to do that. We didn't want declarations so that you'd have to do a lot of pre-work in order to get things done. Like if you're trying to call a routine, you shouldn't have to remember whether you're passing in integers or floating point numbers. You just pass in numbers and the routine can figure that out. We had a set of primitive data types for working with data, and they're similar to the ones in R. Later on, things got extended a little bit, but we basically have numerical, character string, and logical data types. You can throw in a null and an NA and a couple of other things. And then finally, there was a composite data type, a list of named other things, other data. We wanted to have a powerful subscripting concept, and I'll talk about that in a second. Persistent storage so that when the machine crashed, which it often did, you didn't lose everything. And we didn't want artificial constraints because we'd lived under them for so long. It was like a reaction against some of the Fortran things that we'd encounter. So in Fortran, for example, you could have a subscript, but it had to be of the form number times variable plus number. It couldn't be anything else. And there were these, because it was meant to let the compiler do easy hopping through data, right? And you could do that if you had that simple form. Well, we didn't want all that kind of constraint. So we thought, okay, we'll do it a different way. We'll get rid of that. So subscripting. You can have a numeric subscript. This is all stuff you'll know from R. So if you've got an array and you give it the indices of the pieces of the array you want, it'll give them back. But on the other hand, you give it the indices of the pieces you don't want with a negative subscript, and it gives back whatever else is there, because sometimes it's easier to say what you don't want. Logical, you can compute some kind of expression that says, I only want the things that are greater than zero, or the things that are where the residual is bigger than 1,000. And empty subscripts were sort of interesting because not only could they be computed, but empty subscripts are really nice when you're doing multi-way arrays, and all the subscripting works for multi-way arrays too. So I think that was one of the really powerful elements that we had when we came up with the idea for S. The assignment operator, this is another one where we've had some discussions about this one, and I think in R now you can use an equal sign for assignment. Well, I fought that. I'm still fighting. So the idea of using this little arrow was that you didn't make any demands on the name that was on the left side of the arrow, the pointy side of the arrow. The name just said, this is the name I'm going to use to hold this data. And if you didn't have special command completion or Emacs or VI mode editing or a fancy terminal where you could insert things that were missing, you could also use the arrow in the other direction if you managed to type a big thing and then you decided, I forgot to save it. So so one of the things that's come up, and I hope I can clear up a mystery for people, why did we use underscore for assignment? Okay, so here's why. Here's a Teletype 37 keyboard, and if you look here at the O character, which I see that little arrow? That was a single character on the Teletype 37. And this is one of the places where we maybe weren't quite broad enough in our thinking to realize that Teletype 37s at 10 characters a second were slow, and that maybe that wouldn't stay around forever. This actually reminds me a little of APL, which was another language that did multi-way array kind of computations. It actually did a really nice job of working on all the little edge cases about what happens when things are empty and all that. Maybe sometimes better than we did. But I didn't say that. But anyway, APL, its downfall, I think, was that you had to use a completely different character set for everything. So you had arrows and rows and Greek letters and all sorts of other stuff. It made it very compact to write, but it was more like a little math paper that you might be reading in a math journal, and you had to know all the nomenclature, and you had to be able to type it, which meant you'd get this weird back in the old days again, type ball on an IBM Selectric typewriter. You could change the type ball, and the type ball would have all those other funny characters on it, and you could type APL, but then you had to change it back if you wanted to type a letter. So anyway, I hope that clears up a little something. All right, well, meanwhile, here's Dennis Ritchie and Ken Thompson sitting on the fifth floor at Bell Labs. So they were one quarter over and a couple floors up from where we were. And that's a mini computer. That's not a big computer. That's a mini computer. And that's a PDP-11. And see the Teletype 37 sitting next to it? So that was the thing that you had. And those little circular things, you know what those are? Tapes, deck tapes. So not the big tapes that you'd see if you look at some old movie about computing, but these were little tapes. And so they, along with floppy disks and everything else, have gone by the wayside, but they were pretty cool at the time. Anyway, Dennis and Ken were at the labs because they had been working on the Multics program, the Multics operating system. Bell Labs was a partner with MIT and RCA, was it? Somebody else? General Electric. In trying to do that Multics operating system. For some reason, before I got there, they decided to get out of the business. We ended up with our General Electric computer, but not the operating system. And Dennis and Ken didn't have a project to work on anymore. And so they found this PDP-11 and decided, well, we'll write our own operating system on the PDP-11. And I think Brian Kernahan was the one who came up with the name Unix as opposed to Multics, because it was all small. By 1978, the Bell Labs Technical Journal, that was one of the really nice things about Bell Labs, you had your own journal too, right? So there's a lot going on in the thing, and you'd get things about transistors and lasers and fiber optics and all sorts of things coming in the Bell Labs Technical Journal. But this was an issue devoted completely to Unix. And Unix was one of those projects where I don't think management wanted it, but they got it anyway. And they didn't really try that hard to control the researchers. So Dennis and Ken wanted to do it. They did it. Turned out it was useful for a few things, but it was always the big, the management side of that was always, IBM's put 3,000 man years of work into their OS 360 operating system. So how are we ever going to compete with that? Why would you even try? And so, but Unix actually took off a little bit. And there were pieces of Unix that we got to have on our GE computer, RAT4, struct, yak, m4. So there's Brian Kernahan from back in the day. Brian wrote RAT4 as a structured version of Fortran. So remember, we have a ton of Fortran sitting over there. And now we can use a language that's a little nicer in syntax. We don't have go-to statements going all over the place. And you do it in RAT4. Brenda Baker decided, well, we've got all this Fortran code sitting around. Wouldn't it be nice to turn it into RAT4? That was actually a much more interesting reverse problem. Take old crummy Fortran and turn it into RAT4. And so we actually used struct to turn our SCS library into RAT4. And then once you saw it in that form, you could actually often clean it up and understand it better. Steve Johnson wrote Yak. So Yak is this compiler. So you'd give it a grammar, like we had for S, and it would write a compiler for you. So it meant that you just had to work out the grammar, and the rest of the coding was simple. It was already done. And then the M4 macro processor was a system that Dennis Ritchie and Brian Kernighan worked on that would take macro definitions and expand them into their expand the call into the definition, substituting all sorts of stuff in it, lots of different capabilities. M4 is still around, but we use that on top of Fortran to again make Fortran more amenable to doing the implementation of what we wanted. So M4 didn't always work. I had some mail from 1976 with Brian Kernighan, where he was, you can see the times, he was rapidly installing M4 and making changes to it one evening in 76. So this was early on when we were doing our S work. So we wrote S in portable Fortran to run on this GE thing with all these wacky transfer vectors so that everything could be linked separately, so that any new function you put in, you only had to compile and load it. It would be in an executable form on disk, and then the nice little parser that we wrote in Yak would run a parse, evaluate, print loop. And that's all it was. You'd parse the data, parse the expression that the user had typed. You'd evaluate it by walking the parse tree and loading up the functions that were to be called, calling them, and then when you had the final result, you'd print it. So that's pretty much the same loop that's gone on with R, right? So you know that kind of thing. And we also were able to dynamically load a graphics device driver. So this was sort of the picture with the, we had one little place where functions lived, and they all were wrapped up, the algorithms were wrapped up, and they'd go in that little function spot. And so it would just load the functions as it needed them, execute them, and the data was actually beyond the graphics partition in a part of memory. But the size of that function partition was 20K words. They were 36-bit words back in the GE635 time. So 20K words, and that, any function that we worked on had to fit in there. That was graphics, everything. So by statistics day, right, you know, Bell Labs was big. So there were a lot of statisticians. There were maybe 400 of them, I think, that got together for statistics day across the whole of the Bell system. And we introduced S, except we didn't know its name. Notice it just said an interactive language for data analysis. So, and it turned out it was five of us now. You see the names at the bottom, John and me, along with Doug Dunn, Gene McRae and Judy Schilling, and we also gave some other talks a little later in 1977 about S, one in January. So this whole 40 years of S is about the right date, right? So we had the idea of squaring the circle back in May. We've got a system in December, January. So here's Doug Dunn, Gene McRae, and Judy Schilling. They sort of dropped off by the wayside over time, and so they don't get the credit they deserve for being there. Sorry about all the pictures. As I said, these are sort of Xeroxes of a scan of something bad. But it was actually another nice thing at Bell Labs, because they had a pictorial directory of research, and so that's what these are coming from. So by November of 77, so this was a little later, we had a whole 17-page memo about S. This is what Bell Labs' cover sheet looked like. Here's all the people, and we'd actually given it a name, I think. Yeah, there it is. Down near the bottom, you can see the S in quotes. It was always a little hard to figure out, because, you know, S is just a single letter, and we sort of thought maybe it needed some protection with the quotes, but you'll see as we go on, those went away. here, I think we've got single quotes now around the S up here. And so, but he had a whole 153 pages by then, so it was getting bigger. And S was growing in a very similar way to the way Unix was growing, that you didn't have to write a whole system anymore. You had to write an algorithm. So it could grow, and people could give you ideas, and we could insert them into it. So this is September of 78. This is our second version. We had done some rewriting in order to fit on a Unix machine. So this is a letter that Henry Pollack, well, this is actually the reply to Henry Pollack from Sam Morgan. Sam Morgan was Henry's co-level person in the computer science research area, and he's basically saying, they're going to get a whole second 67 megabyte disk on this computer, and we're allowed to use 3 megabytes of it to work on S. So this was a 32-bit machine. It was designed to look sort of like an IBM 360, an Interdata 832. And so we had a chance to actually work with a real Unix system, a different operating system. It was fun. And then after we had done that, we thought, you know what? The real research, the real interesting stuff is still happening on the PDP-11. So we sort of snuck our way onto the PDP-11. And we were able to work on a 16-bit machine. This is back in the day where you could have 64K bytes of storage. And then when it became a PDP-1170, there's separate instruction and data space, so you could have two kinds of 64K hunks of memory and not very much disk, I think. I don't remember the size of the disk, but when you look at that Interdata 67 megabyte disk, you can be pretty sure that the PDP-11 didn't have very much more. So we were actually able, just one more thing about the implementation of that, we couldn't fit the parser and a function in memory. So we actually swapped the parser in to parse the thing and then swapped that out as we did the evaluation in the print loops. So there's a lot of data swapping going on. So nicely, Stu Feldman and Peter Weinberger wrote a Fortran 77 compiler. This was back when F77 was a specification of a compiler, Fortran 77, the new sort of structured Fortran. It was supposed to be the best thing. AT&T was in the middle of implementing one of those. They had a specification document for implementing it that was like 3 inches thick, and it was going to take them, I don't know, how many years. Well, Stu and Peter just decided to write it, and so I don't know what it took, maybe like 3 months, but it was like one of Brian Kernahan's things where he said, I never really wanted to do a project that I thought was going to take more than a month. It always did take a little more than a month, but never wanted to start out thinking it was going to be that big. And so here's the same thing. Peter and Stu just wrote a Fortran 77 compiler from scratch and didn't bother with the specifications and all the process involved. So now we had our Fortran, and the Fortran compiler actually basically mapped into C intermediate code, and so Fortran and C, which C was growing up with Unix, right? Fortran and C now could talk to each other and they could work together. And so we could take our whole SCS library, all of our nice Fortran routines, we could use C on the outside to make our implementation life easier. We could use all of the underlying Unix system calls to work with things. And so we just decided, you know what, nobody's going to put the energy in to implementing a portable Fortran version of S, because it's a lot of work. So what are they going to do? Unix is going to get ported, because that's pretty interesting. And then let's just, if we can latch onto Unix and we can just port along with Unix, then we can port to anywhere. And so we did that. And then we made, Well, then Alan came. And this is Alan Wilkes. He came in 1980. He helped us with our C implementation. He really was a sharp computer science guy. He had been a system administrator. He was a real ace in terms of the computing stuff. And we did a lot of that implementation of S in C when Alan first came in 1980. He went back to Princeton, and then he came back. And so he brought a lot of new energy to us. So we were publicizing S, trying to get it throughout AT&T and Bell Labs. So this is 1980 in the Bell Labs news. But here's the big thing. This is May 1980. See the date up there. We were licensing S to go outside. And this was basically the same terms as the Unix license. So not only had we latched onto Unix in terms of being able to move with Unix, but we latched onto their licensing agreement too. And the licensing agreement was basically because AT&T was a monopoly at the time. This was before the 1984 agreement to split the Bell system up. They basically had to give away the software. And so we did the same thing. The license was written by lawyers, and so it basically said, to paraphrase, said, we're going to send you a tape. You have to send us a couple hundred bucks, I think. We're going to send you a tape. We don't guarantee there's anything on the tape, but if there is, you might find out that it's code of some sort, and it might compile. And if you can get it to compile, it might actually run, and it might do something. But we don't guarantee any of that. Nevertheless, some people, like people at the University of Washington, Doug Martin, took a chance on that kind of thing, and they got it to compile and they got it to run, and so they were able to run Unix on their S on their Unix machines, and that was all good. Here's a little note from Francine Glick, who was our actual AT&T Bell Labs librarian, and she was the one who actually distributed these S tapes in the beginning. So in 1980, we sent out 8. And in 1981, there were 26. And 1982, just the first 3 months, were 25. So it was actually getting pretty popular. And this is the same model that happened with Unix, that once it got out there, people used it, people wanted to work with it. They got the source code, they could play with it. That was a really important thing that we decided and worked hard to do. And I think John had a lot to do with getting the powers that be to allow us to do that. There was a lot of political stuff going on. So by 1984, we had a real book. This was the book that described the language that we'd implemented in C. It was 52 pages. And this was published by Wadsworth, and so that was all good. We got more publicity outside. We wrote an article for the CACM on the design of S. Unix Review had this really interesting S guy. and somewhere, we actually still have the original art for that because we reached out and thought we needed that on the wall at Bell Labs. We decided to write an interface language, which was a way for us and for other people to write that square around the circle to allow you to import algorithms into S. So we wrote this interface language. It was kind of crappy language. Sorry. but it sort of inherited all of the limitations of Fortran and M4, and there were all these little interfaces. Whenever you've got multiple tools that you're using together, you sort of inherit all the quirks of all the tools. And so once you've got all the quirks of all the tools, it gets to be a real pain. But it was real, and you could do it. So people could get this book extending the S system, and they could write their own algorithms that would fit into S. So much like R has made so much easier in packages and things like that, we did have that concept. So about this time, John got the hankering to be a manager. And so he moved to another building. I wish I'd brought the picture back, but I don't think I want to go back 50 pages. So he moved to Building 5, which was up the hill from Murray Hill, and he got his own department, and he was running a computing data analysis kind of department up there. And I think the basic reason he went there was he wanted to manage, and nobody ever left research. And so the management ranks were pretty hard to get. So he went there. Meanwhile, Alan Wilkes came to the labs, and we started working in statistics research with Alan. And then John came back with a whole new language called QPE, Quantitative Programming Environment. And so we had this interesting problem. We've got a sort of robust version of S going along. We've got this new language called QPE, and it had some really interesting ideas in it. And what do? So we argued it out. It came out 3-0 in favor of merging the two. And so we had a new S language. And the new S language is the one where functions were full class objects in the language. It brought a lot nicer implementation to the whole thing, and now we had 700 pages. Although some of that's cheating, right? Because the whole back of the book was all the documentation for the functions themselves. So here's a quick timeline of what went on with S. The top part here is just releases. So here's we had a release of S in 82, and there was some more going on here. John started out QPE around 82. We merged here in 87, and new S was released in 88. So that's sort of the general time frame. Here's the machines we were working with, Honeywell GECOS. Honeywell took over from GE with our GE 635. The first year, they basically took all the GEs out of the source code. So everything had GE something in it, and they took all the E's out. So it was there. So that was mainly what happened with the Honeywell. The Innerdata was that small IBM-like machine that we worked on. We went to a VAX. I forgot to put the other Unix version 7 machine in there, the PDP-11 that we worked with. But then we went to a VAX, which was 32 bits. We could use a much bigger space for our instructions and data. We started working on smaller machines, a 3B2, which was looked like a little pizza box, Sun machines, MIPS machines from Silicon Graphics. So the machines were getting faster and better and smaller, and that's all good, right? That's Moore's law. So we were lucky to be able to sort of latch onto that and move along with the increasing power of the machines. We had our memo there. This was a brown book, but not the brown book that anybody else knows, not the one that you saw the picture of. I have one or two of them. John has one too. They were a comb binding. They were pretty thick. They were a Bell Labs issue, and they had an interesting cover to them, but I wasn't able to produce a picture of it. But it was also brown. And then we had the other brown book, the S Interactive Language, and then here's new S. And then Trevor comes in at the models side, so he just sort of falls off the edge of the timeline here. And we were working with printer plots back in the old days and Tektronix storage scopes, where you'd draw something and it would stick because the scope itself would store it, as opposed to the more modern systems where the graphics would continually regenerate and you could be interactive. We had an AED512, which was a color thing. That was the first color that we got. Color was in there in S, but not very strong. It certainly didn't have areas of color. And the AED512 got us into that. There were some cheap pen plotters that came along. People would say, well, guys, you come to the conferences and you tell us about these $100,000 machines that we have to buy to do graphics. And here we could see that
you could do graphics for a few thousand dollars. So it was really nice. You could get high quality, line drawn graphics at the time. PostScript came along right around 85. The X windowing system came along, and we latched onto that as well. So there were a lot of things where somebody else did something good, and we picked it up. SCS and GRZ sort of died out. There's not much going on there. And then here's the people timeline. Alan came for a year. John left for a couple years. John came back, and Alan came back, and then we were all a happy family again. And so that's sort of the overall timeline. So I've just got a couple minutes to talk about why this language has stayed around for 40 years. We built it for ourselves. I think that was the biggest thing. We wanted to use it. We built something we wanted to use. We worked on it because we wanted to work to do the things we wanted to do. The other people at Bell Labs, the other statisticians there, had the same idea. They wanted to do work with it. And they brought in different problems they wanted to work on. They brought in algorithms that they'd work with. We weren't trying to produce a commercial product, so we didn't have anybody saying, okay, we've got to come out with a new release because they're demanding it out there in the world, or it just needs to be out there. We had this general model that all of us had to agree on what we put into the language. There's a concept that Brian Kernahan and Rob Pike talked about called the lifeboat principle in operating systems. And it was basically, if you wanted to add a new feature, you wanted to add somebody else to the lifeboat, you had to throw something out. And so the idea was, make the stuff you put in general and clean and useful, and don't put in a lot of junk, because the other junk you'll throw out anyway. So we didn't design this for any particular computing hardware, because we were just hanging on with Unix, right? So we could float along as Unix went from piece of hardware to another piece of hardware. And so that was a very nice thing to have. So Moore's Law and the general computing development over the course of the years really helped. So we got a freebie from that. S is programmable. So once we had the new language where people could write functions in the language itself, then everything got a lot easier. So a lot more of S, as we went to the Blue Book, a lot more of S became written in S. So just like the Unix operating system was written in C, and the C compiler was written in C, and you know, everything got written in C eventually. So most everything in S got written in S, except for some of the low-level algorithms that we wanted to bring along. We interfaced to other languages, C and Fortran. We got a chance to redo S three times, right? So might consider that good or bad. It's a lot of work, but each time you do it, you figure out, What could I have done better? What was chafing at us? And so we were able to get around that as we implemented it again and again. And just generally, we wanted this to be interactive, easy to use, all the things that I talked about that were bothering me from the first time I came to work with interactive Fortran. And the language operates on whole vectors at a time. So unlike the programming languages that were typical for implementing an operating system or something like that, S was designed from the beginning to operate on whole big collections of data. So I think those are a collection of reasons why S has stood the test of time, and it's, there we go. Along came R. So the impetus there was AT&T had started licensing it. It was now AT&T that could actually ask for money for licensing it. People said, we don't want to pay money for licensing it. Let's just re-implement it again. And so it became R. And R has gone on, and it's done great things. And it's really nice to see everybody continuing that work. So thank you all.
Thank you very much, Rick. That was a great review of how things happened. If anyone has questions, we've got maybe time for one quick question. We're going to take our break shortly. There's microphones if you need them.
Thought I'd get to sit down.
Well, as you can imagine, this isn't entirely a question. The first observation, which I think Rick admits to, is you might have noticed that Rick is a pack rat. The only other thing I want to say, and I'll say it very quickly, often I'm asked, why is R doing well? You know, why have other people written statistical languages and they've come and gone? Why has R come and grown and grown and grown? And Rick really said it, but let me just say it once again. From the very beginning, it was a case of a community of statisticians and others who wanted to do something and themselves took the action to create something that did it better. And that's exactly why R has done well. It's not because of one or two or even the R core group. It's because you guys, the whole community, not only use the language, but contribute to it. And I think that's why S did so well.
That was the question?
That was the question.
Anyone else?
So were missing values a rare thing? I've always been surprised that you have to put in any remove is true to get rid of them if you want to get a result if there's missing.
Well, the thing about missing values, first off, NAs were unusual in computer architecture at the time. So it wasn't until a little later that computers at the hardware level thought of a missing value as anything special, not a number. But then it wasn't always obvious what you wanted to do with missing values. There were some people that would say, well, look, got a missing values, let's just stick in averages for all of them. Or let's figure out how to impute some interesting value that should go where the missing value is so you don't have missing values. If you're in a multivariate situation, you've got missing values scattered throughout a data matrix, if you remove the whole row, you know, sort of all the data involving that particular missing value, you may end up just having nothing left. So it's a difficult situation. So we wanted to have the placeholder for missing value. Sometimes we thought removing them all was fine, but we didn't necessarily make that a default, and we made it so that if you had missing values and you didn't know you had them, because maybe they came up in a computation somewhere, that you didn't just silently compute on them and not know that they were there.
We had a whole tutorial on missing values yesterday.
So it's a difficult problem.
So one of your slides talked about lists having named components. And I've always been curious about when you combine the components into a list, the names are dropped by default. Any ideas to why? Like with matrix, it won't drop the names, but when you use a list to combine them, the names will be dropped.
This is more of a technical detail.
Yeah, okay,
Okay, I did get into it with the arrow, so I guess we got into some lower level technical things.
Okay, well, I think it's time for the break. We're going to take a 30-minute break, but let's thank Rick again for a wonderful history of this.